Chapter 3. Old World Disorder. After Atlantis was constructed, the alien visitors sought to establish the new order over their minions, the erstwhile natural and nature-loving inhabitants of the Earth. Their common rationale was the same as John Milton's fictional archangelic renegade, Lucifer: better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Paradise Lost. One of the ways in which they sought to accomplish their goal involved biogenetic interference with an alteration of the indigenous Earth inhabitants. Such a practice was known to be a cardinal sin, and so, originally, normal sexual intercourse was attempted with unsatisfactory results. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all that they chose. Genesis 6-8. And the daughters of Cain with whom the angels had companied conceived, but they were unable to bring forth their children, and they died. And of the children who were in their wombs, some died, and some came forth, having split open the bellies of their mothers. They came forth by their navels, the Ethiopian Kebranagast. Extraterrestrials visit neighboring planets and galaxies, but they rarely interfere with the evolution of the species that they find there. This edict the Nephilim disregarded, and they knew that there would be a penalty for their heinous actions. In the Book of Enoch, we read of the Nephilim leader, called Samjaza, Enzel, Belial, Enlil, etc., speaking of the deed to his 200 brethren. And then Samjaza, who was their leader, said unto them, I fear ye will not indeed agree to do this deed, and I alone shall have to pay the penalty of a great sin. Individuals were selected from various tribes and lowered to Atlantis, perhaps under the pretext of being chosen and specially favored. As part of other nefarious stratagems, we find that large sections of certain tribes were lowered and corralled in Atlantis. It may be noted that though it is now common, it is not normal for mankind to congregate and live in cities. This is entirely artificial. The design of the continent of Atlantis was created in such a way as to make possible the segregation of populations while the surveys and researches were ongoing. See Planet of the Apes. The Earth's natural pre-visitation caretakers may have been the Neanderthals, Cro-Magnon, or even the Angus peoples. Though these peoples have always been put before us as backward and dull-witted, the paleoarchaeologists are finding evidence that contradicts these commonly held assumptions. Nearly all the theories that have perpetuated this conjecture are now antiquated and unsustainable. It is known, however, that these Neanderthals suddenly vanished from the Earth for no known reason. Authors Max H. Flint and Otto O. Binder wrote in their book, Mankind, Child of the Stars, Cro-Magnon man appeared with a mysteriously improved skeletal characteristics and with a cranial capacity that is amazingly in excess by 100 cubic centimeters of that of modern man. A similarly large degree of brain expansion occurred in absolutely no other species on Earth in all the ages of the past. Not has any genus shown evidence of brain mutation of a comparable magnitude since antiquity. Those ever so lucky persons who were chosen for hybridization by the Nephilim inherited the alien DNA and became morally corrupt. Some of these persons were sent back into their tribes as kings possessed of powerful magic and wealth. Henceforth, bloodline would be extremely important to the monarchs of the Earth. Records were kept in Atlantis of all their engineered slaves, and from then onwards, the progeny of those persons would be favored and protected. Some writers contend that after hybridization, the genetically manipulated individuals have very extended lifetimes and could maintain the same form for many hundreds of years. In prehistory, most tribes were predominantly of the matriarchal type, which is why all Bronze Age villages were circular in design. Even the later concept of the Arthurian Round Table indicates the idea that no one man is head, and that kingship, sic, kinship, arises from the camaraderie and collaboration of all, not the ego-driven, autocratic travesties of later periods. In many cultures, the dead warriors were buried in circular cairns or mounds called sids, pronounced chi. This word connotes female breast, and the burial chambers actually look like such from outside. The implication is that the dead are placed again inside the womb, the breasts, the symbols of renewed life. The Egyptians used to place their dead within sarcophagi that were symbols of the female body. In fact, the interior of the lid of the sarcophagus had the image of the night sky as the overarching body of the mother goddess Nuth. Clearly, the monarchies of any age have been responsible for atrocious crimes. And yet, The monarchs themselves claim rulership by divine right. James VI of Scotland became James I of England and was the main proponent of this. The origins of the sanctity of kings goes back to pre-diluvian times, however. The state of monarchy is the most supreme thing upon earth, for kings are not only God's lieutenants upon earth, and sit upon God's throne, but even by God himself are called gods, and so their power after a certain relation compared to divine power. For if you will consider the attributes to God, you shall see how they agree in the person of a king. To dispute what God does is blasphemy, so it is sedition in subjects to dispute what a king may do in the height of his power. I would not have you meddle with such ancient rights of mine as I have received from my predecessors, James VI, King of Scotland and England. On Atlantis, the segregated or imprisoned groups had their biology studied and experiments were continued for centuries. Along with their supersensory skills, the Nephilim also possessed great knowledge of biology, crystallography, organic computing, and robotics, etc. Such sciences were common in pre-diluvian epochs and are not discoveries of our Silicon Age. Many scholars have pondered why it is that certain ancient cultures like the Sumerian, Indo-Aryan and Egyptian have alphabets, mathematical concepts, and symbolic cosmologies, all just appearing fully formed without record of the normal antecedent and cumulatory stratifications that must attend these achievements. Here are some examples of the quandaries that beset the scholars and academes. Sir Leonard Woolley in his Ur of the Chaldees wrote, "There is nothing to show to what race the first inhabitants of Mesopotamia belonged, at a date which we cannot fix. People of a new race made their way into the valley, coming whence we do not know." And Professor W. B. Emery wrote in his Archaic Egypt the following, "At approximately 3,400 years BC a great change took place in Egypt and the country passed rapidly from a state of advanced Neolithic culture to two well-organized monarchies." At the same time writing appears, "Monumental architecture and the arts and crafts developed to an astonishing degree. There appears to be little or no background to these fundamental developments." In Colin Renfrew's Before Civilization, the following passage, "Archaeologists all over the world have realized that much of prehistory as written in the existing textbooks is inadequate, some of it quite simply wrong. It has been suggested that the changes now at work in prehistory herald the shift to a new paradigm, made necessary by the collapse of the first paradigm. After hybridization, certain chosen ones from the Earthmen were also brought into the inner circles of the visitors. This would have been done for purely pragmatic reasons. Some of those genetically modified were sent back to their societies and exalted as priests, elders, or even kings. They were lackeys of the malign warlocks of Atlantis who really ruled from behind the thrones, keeping in touch with their minions through the use of powerful crystal-seeing stones." In Our Haunted Planet by John Keel, we read, "According to the traditions of many isolated peoples, the first great emperors in Asia were god-kings who came down from the sky, displayed amazing superhuman abilities, and took over. There was a veritable worldwide epidemic of these god-kings between 5000 and 1000 BC. They were also capable of telepathic communications. Their close worldwide cooperation has been maintained by instantaneous intercommunication by telepathy which has taught them, Eklil Kushana, the ultimate frontier. It is from these times that we have the concept of initiation into the so-named mysteries, which were always some kind of sequestered knowledge of enormous portent that only a few special severely tested persons could know about. Later, it was thought, after mankind defied the alien despots, some of these initiation processes were maintained for the keeping of the knowledge sacred and out of their hands. These false envoys and overlords imposed taxation, enforced slavery and sacrifice, and generally lived off the labor of the hybrid Earth people. The indigenous people of Earth did not rebel immediately against these foreign oppressors. Strong assertive leaders, it seems, were needed after the destruction of Tiamat and the subsequent terrestrial calamities. The false ones promised consolidation, order, safety, and privilege. They instigated hierarchic control, the division of labor, merit-oriented advance, and induced conditions that inevitably led to man's disconnection from nature. Necessity fostered the worst of tyrannies to descend on prehistoric humanity. Note, humankind would not just create or accept such structures as a matter of course. It takes extraordinary circumstances for the millennia-old, symbiotic umbilical connection to the planet of origin and to the universal order to be occluded and for humankind's thonic sensibility and natural love to become sublimated and directed away from its prime source and object into purely pragmatic power relations. It is logical to assume that these incongruent and deviant patterns have not arisen merely as a matter of course, as a consequence of the erstwhile organic evolution of our species. As modern intellectuals advocate, we feel that it is more consistent with the facts to posit some external interference, and there are many myths, legends, and sagas that conceal, behind the wide and complex panoply of euphemisms and allegories, allusions to this very predicament. From the presence of the aliens and from their overt dominion, we have the creation of competitive sports, tests of prowess, and the exaltation of the muscular skills. There also came the pursuit of aggressive warfare and the conquest of other tribes and nations. There came the division of people into superior and inferior groups. We must ask, are such habits intrinsic to Earth humans? Are they productive? Would they not be more commensurate with the agenda of those spent on weakening the populations of the Earth, on embroiling them in futile and destructive wars, on arousing aggressive instincts, which cause so much systemic and social despair? From their presence came the reality of ritual murder and human sacrifice to further instill fear and provide sustenance to the gods of the underworld, sick, night sky. This accounts partly for why once great and benign civilizations, peaceful and respectful of nature, suddenly descend into debauchery and civil strife. In the legends of the Tahoe California Indians, for instance, we read of the strife. There was a time when their tribe possessed the whole earth and were strong and numerous and rich, but a day came when a people rose up stronger than they and defeated and enslaved them. Afterward, the Great Spirit sent an immense wave across the continent from the sea, and this wave engulfed both the oppressors and the oppressed, all but a very small remnant. The records of hundreds of cultures led us to the conclusion that their eventual decline and fall was indeed due to external interference. The alien invaders and their lackeys also instilled the idea, now so all-pervasive, that nature was threatening and antithetical to humankind, something to be abused and possessed. This instinct is certainly not natural to terrestrial humans but would be consistent with the outlook of those not from this planet. It is extremely unlikely that such a pernicious philosophy could originate from within humankind. For reasons that should now be apparent, historians have suppressed most of the evidence of the pre-Diluvian matriarchies. All the various tenets of post-Diluvian religion have their roots in the lexicons of those spent on mind control and the enslavement of humankind. The utter perversity of their natures could not be better revealed than by the philosophical perusal of these so-called religious credos. A study of Christian history discloses the portentous fact that the concept of the malignancy of matter, coming into the movement from Hinduism through Zoroastrianism, became an influence overwhelmingly dominating the theology and the ethic. It bred the monstrous cult of asceticism, whose driving motivation was the idea that the instincts of the flesh must be crushed down in the interests of the spirit. The tragic consequence of this staggering default of insight are incalculable, but in all conscience overwhelming to any intelligence that discerns it. It lay the Christian mind open to the obsession of a psychological influence that has been nothing less than devastating to sanity, inflicting upon the psyche a trauma that has produced morbidity and crushed to a degree the natural instinct for human happiness, Alvin Boyd Kuhn, the ultimate canon of knowledge. From these malefactors comes the notion of the removed God, a distant, immaterial and punitive demiurge that requires man to repress natural instincts and live in constant guilt. From them also comes the pernicious concept of a fallen God who tempts the unwary and leads one into everlasting perdition. They also instilled the fallacy that women are lower in ontological status than men and that they are to be distrusted and kept in subordinate positions. Polygamy, another practice pervasive in certain ancient societies, was again based on the need for these biologically superior entities to reproduce their kind as fast as was possible. Keeping women in submissive positions and having them uneducated mitigated against them ever wondering why they were being used as incubators. Tribes who are in true harmony with nature and who desire to remain so are instinctively repulsed by the overpopulation of the Earth. See the works of Professor L.A. Waddell. Rebellion broke out on Atlantis, possibly due to a falling out between factions of the oppressors, with one group, as a result, taking sides with the humans. Some say that a small group of alien priests took pity on the Earth and sought to restore the natural rule, or close to the original condition. See David Wood's Genesis, 8 First Book of Revelation. Others contend that it occurred due to the intervention of galactic forces that sought to eradicate the Bent Ones from this planet, or at least restrict their corrupting operations. Whatever the actual truth, it appears the rebels decided that it would be futile to go into the individual colonies throughout the Earth to depose the Atlantean demigods. Better to strike at the root of the problem, Atlantis itself. Note, many world myths and legends speak of wars between the giants. The stories have uncanny similarities and may refer to this attempt of Earth inhabitants to eradicate strange demonic visitors. It has been noted, for instance, that the Mahabharata in India, the Trojan Wars and the Gaelic Wars in Ireland, all occurred relatively simultaneously. See Emanuel Velikovsky. In the story of Beowulf, one of the first romances of the later Anglo-Saxon period, we again find the story of demonic forces that live in the wild places and prey off the people. The romances have the same refrain wherever they are found. All speak of the banished hybrids, living on islands or under the earth. Is this a mere story that is put before us? Was it all just creative license? Grendel, this monster grim, was called March River Mighty, in Merland Living, in Fen and Fastness, fief of the giants the hapless Widowell had kept since the creator his exile doomed. Unkin of Cain was the killing avenged by sovereign god for slaughtered Abel. Ill fared his feud, and far was he driven, for the slaughter's sake, from sight of men. Of Cain awoke all that woeful breed, Edens and elves and evil spirits, as well as the giants that warred with God weary while, but their wage was paid them. Beowulf Prelude, Episode 1. On Atlantis, the peoples of the sequestered colonies of original Earth inhabitants, forewarned of this coming rebellion, would have been prepared to vacate the precincts and overthrow the tyrannical technocratic elites. Knowledge, instruments, and books were rescued and preserved. The freed persons moved onto the waters in ships and with the use of certain devices attempted to relocate their respective lands. Some that were not able to do this settled on lands that were unfamiliar. This is clearly the case with the Gaels. In fact, it is recorded that they came to Ireland from four sacred islands that were destroyed because the rulers were corrupt. In Irish myth, we read of the successive waves of colonists, each declaring that, although in opposition politically, they were kindred to those already in situ. The story of the migrations has survived down to modern times and been retold in masterworks of fiction and non-fiction. See Charles Squire, Jim Fitzpatrick, Morgan Llewellyn, Ursula Le Guin, Frank Herbert, and Robert Holdstock. Many of the people who left Atlantis after the overthrow were themselves genetically altered and possessed what was called magical powers, which awed all that were witness to them. The extraterrestrial priests who sided with the Earth people set themselves up as kings, or more likely as the advisors of the indigenous but magically endowed kings. The Arthurian legends speak of such beings, for instance, Merlin. In other Celtic myths, we have Taliesin, Emergen, Tuan, Breeze, Balor, Dianzacht, Indach, Elithan, Liu, Nuida, Culhulain, Oshin, Finn Mac Cumhail, and a host of others. In these and other stories, the advisor, leader, or king has pronounced strength, wisdom, clairvoyance, beauty, and long life, which are all the possible results of genetic modification. One may also recall the strange attributes of the Russian warlock, Grigory Rasputin, enigmatic occult advisor to the Romanov dynasty of the 19th century. Grigory is a Greek word for fallen angel. See Alex de Jong's Rasputin. In many cases, he also possessed a familiar weapon or talisman with magical properties. Magic was the word used for high technologies not understood by the witnesses of the day. If a machine works perfectly, the results are like magic. The Celtic sagas are full of mention of magical weapons and treasures. One of the latter was the sacred stone of Fal that was placed under the throne of the king in Tara, Drumcane or Hill of the Serpents. This stone, it was said, would cry out if a false one sat to be crowned. We might ask what mystery is secreted in this myth. The word Fal actually means stone and is the root of the word phallic. The stone of Fal is, therefore, the stone of stones, probably a powerful crystal that would indicate if a person was genetically altered in some way. This stone, like the lingam of the Hindus, was believed to be connected to the planet Saturn, for whom the earthly kings ruled. In folklore, there are covert references to genetic manipulation. Consider the entity called a changeling. Was this an alien substitute for a human infant? Moreover, in prehistoric times, it was impossible for anyone to rule in Ireland if they were blemished, a rule that was assiduously honored. Could blemish be a reference to artificial alteration? The world's folklore is replete with warnings about witches who can be identified as evil because of their strange markings or deformities. Though later mundane history tells of much abuse of such lore, it is reasonable to assume that they were founded on some factuality. This is also the reason why there is the emphasis on purity of the bloodline when it comes to kingship. This purity was essential to both sides, each having a vested interest in having only their own lineage enthroned. Innumerable rituals associated with kingship date from this, and in certain tribes there is the custom of being bonded by blood. In such ceremonies, a person who has come to love and respect another, lets physical blood and literally presses this to that of his fellow who has likewise let free their blood. Is this just another meaningless heathen ritual? Does this not mean that kindredness has to do with the same blood, not dissimilar blood? And what are we to make of the Persian tale of the genie in the bottle? Could these tales not also conceal facts about laboratories, evil wizards, hybridization, and genetic manipulation? Not all the returning natives freed from Atlantis found it easy to gain access to their kingdoms or lands or to take control in their enslaved provinces. During the reign of the alien tyrants, the morale of the enslaved was reduced, while superstition and suspicion were rampant. When it was learned that usurpation had occurred on Atlantis, ruling despots feared for themselves and for their exposure and expulsion. Through the adroit use of manipulation and propaganda, they turned the people against the newcomers, often engaging them in battle. In this endeavor, the use of betrayers was especially useful. They spread false rumors that the newcomers were not returning saviors, but dangerous sorcerers who would steal the children and bring disease, all things that the tyrant masters were themselves engaged in. All over the world, we have then one of two possible outcomes. Either the free ones triumph, banishing, imprisoning, or killing the evil ones, or alternatively, the evil ones prevail to continue cruel, inhumanitarian regimes. In this latter scenario, the freed Atlanteans would be killed, betrayed, or imprisoned. They, like the less endowed natives, would live out lives of poverty and servitude. This is the situation that we find in evidence all over the globe coming down into historical times. See the saga of Robin Hood. And since, for the most part, the evil ones remained in power, they had the official histories fabricated to aggrandize themselves and to perpetuate the status quo. Their priestly allies were especially complicit in this endeavor. Their mythographers pushed back in time the dates of the arrival of their masters by hundreds of thousands of years, making it impossible for later scholars to piece together the facts. They also saw to it that facts would be further distorted by creating around the various accounts innumerable elaborations and exaggerations, such as we now find in all myths, legends, and fairy tales. For a certain time, it seems that the efforts of the rebels were successful. The humans probably relied on their physical numbers. However, the evil ones who lost battles or who were deposed continued to practice their vile arts. More importantly, the offspring of those who had been genetically altered also continued to exist and procreate. They had within them the instincts of aggression and power mania innate to their forefathers. It is these persons who moved from the limbic and later the left brain modality who excelled in the technological sciences and were predisposed to feeling separate, distinct from, or superior to the planet's natural inhabitants. They were the ones who found it easy to destroy nature and to manipulate and murder their fellow human beings. Throughout historical time, we find personages rising to the top of political and cultural life who labor so assiduously for technological advance and yet who demonstrably display little love or concern for humanity. Do such scenarios occur for the reasons that we have been conditioned to believe? Can the same set of facts be approached from another angle?